Coming up on The Exchange, it was a busy week at the state capitol in Des Moines. Four hearings were held on issues like minimum wage and workers' compensation, as well as a voter ID bill and a plan to do away with a local water authority in Des Moines. Hundreds of constituents showed up at the hearings, mostly to voice their opposition.
Taken as a whole, House File 295 is a mean-spirited law with no redeeming qualities whatsoever. The majority party conspiring with dark money groups and others to lower the wages of our poor citizens is absolutely the lowest, most despicable thing that has ever happened in this beautiful building.
Also today on The Exchange, we'll introduce a new project of Siouxland Public Media, We Are Not a Monolith. We Are Not a Monolith will produce weekly news and culture about African Americans in the Siouxland community. That and more coming up on The Exchange. But first, this news. Welcome to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. It's been another turbulent week at the Iowa legislature. Contentious bills on several issues have been in and out of committee and will soon be up for debate on the House and Senate floors. Each of these bills warranted public hearings Monday and Tuesday. Hundreds of people showed up to largely oppose a state-mandated minimum wage and the dissolution of the Des Moines Water Works. There was also a lot of opposition voiced in a hearing on a bill that would change the state's workers' compensation system for public employees. First, though, let's take a look at a hearing on the voter ID bill. House File 516 would require Iowa voters to present IDs at the polls. It would also change some of the voter registration requirements in the state. More than 240 people signed up to give testimony Monday night at a state house hearing on the bill. Large numbers of supporters and opponents spoke. Secretary of State Paul Pate is the author of the measure, and he spoke first. He said the bill should make it easy to vote and hard to cheat. Pate said that no one would be denied the right to vote if the bill becomes law.
And I'm adamant about that fact and will fight to ensure voters are not disenfranchised. If you do not already have a form of ID, we will give you one for free automatically.
However, Daniel Zeno of the Iowa branch of the American Civil Liberties Union said that African Americans, the elderly, and people who have no permanent home could have a hard time getting an ID. But Zeno said there are also situations where the bill could hurt people who usually have no problems voting.
The everyday Iowan who's walking down the street and realizes, oh, today's election day, but I forgot my license and I ran to the elementary school to go vote. That Iowan wouldn't be able to vote anymore unless they ran home and hopefully got back to the poll in enough time.
But Emma Aquina Nemechek supported the bill. She's a U.S. citizen who came to Iowa from the Philippines years ago. She now lives in Linn County. She says citizens have to show their ID for just about everything, from cashing a check to applying for Social Security.
It is not too much to ask voters to do this so that they prove their identity. I do not feel discriminated when obliged to show my ID. Secretary Pate's plan will make sure every Iowan who does not already have a driver's license or ID will get one for free. No eligible voter will be turned away.
Daniel Hoffmans testified on behalf of the LGBTQ community. He's the director of the program One Iowa, which advocates for that community. Hoffmans says more than 40% of transgender persons do not have an ID that correctly reflects their gender identity, and that can be a problem.
This bill also includes language that voters can be challenged at the poll if they do not resemble the photo of their ID. Many transgender respondents by the National Transgender Discrimination Survey reported that being harassed, 41% were being harassed for showing a photo ID that did not match their gender identity.
The public hearing on the voter ID bill was one of three held at the state capitol on Monday. The other two were the minimum wage bill and the measure that would dissolve the Des Moines Water Works. More than 150 people signed up to speak about the minimum wage bill. It would allow the state to set a minimum wage and preempt counties that have higher wages. Four Iowa counties have already decided to raise the minimum wage. The legislation would freeze the minimum wage in Iowa at $7.25 an hour. Jessica Dunker was one of two people who spoke out in favor of the measure. Dunker is with the Iowa Restaurant Association. She said the state should set the minimum wage and not the counties.
To continue to be a vibrant and growing part of the state's economy, we need statewide wage and employment solutions, not a patchwork of county-by-county mandates.
Kelly Savage disagreed. She's the state director for the nonprofit Every Child Matters. Savage said a lot of people think that the minimum wage only applies to teenagers, but that's not the case.
Only 1 in 6 minimum wage earners are teenagers, and in fact, 31% of minimum wage earners are age 40 or older. 3/5 of the minimum wage workforce work full-time. 31% of minimum wage earners are parents. This affects our children, too.
One of the people who spoke at the hearing was a college student named Josh Miet. He's a student organizer for Iowa State University. Miet says he knows what it's like to grow up in a low-wage earning family.
My parents were separated when I was 6 years old. My mother worked multiple jobs just to make sure we can keep a roof over our heads. My father works long, strenuous hours in a warehouse in order to support my family, myself and my younger sister. Growing up, my family was very politically apathetic. My parents blamed themselves for the situation that we were in.
Charles Bushman of the Iowa Federation of Labor, AFL-CIO, testified that he was disturbed by many of the actions of Republicans in the Iowa legislature this year. The minimum wage issue was one of the most distressing bills, in his opinion.
Taken as a whole, House File 295 is a mean-spirited law with no redeeming qualities whatsoever. The majority party conspiring with dark money groups and others to lower the wages of our poor citizens is absolutely the lowest, most despicable thing that has ever happened in this beautiful building. Thank you.
Hundreds of people filled a Capitol hearing room on Monday morning to oppose a controversial bill that would dismantle the Des Moines Waterworks. The Des Moines Register reports that overflow crowds gathered in the Statehouse Rotunda with neon signs that read, "This is a Farm Bureau power grab and clean water, not corporate water." The Iowa House bill and a similar bill that was introduced in the Senate would make water utilities in Des Moines, Urbandale, and West Des Moines into city departments subject to the control of their local city councils. Water boards would become advisory boards, city managers would be responsible for hiring managers to run the departments, and decisions on spending and policy would be subject to city council approval. E.J. Giovanetti of the Central Iowa Regional Drinking Water Commission is from Polk County. Giovanetti is against the bill because he said it brings politics into the running of the water systems.
Utilities, particularly water, sewer, metro solid waste, etc., have been insulated from politics by appointed boards. If this goes to city councils, then suddenly you're injecting back into the system that was never intended to be political influence.
Also speaking at the hearing was Leslie Gerhardt of the Des Moines Waterworks. She compared the adversarial situation between the county, the waterworks, and the state to what happened with a recent water disaster in another Midwestern state.
Taking assets of a public water utility is the exact kind of state government meddling that created the public health water crisis in Flint, Michigan. This flies in the face of the respected history of home rule we have in the state.
However, several speakers supported the idea of moving control of the water system to the local city councils. One of them was Peter Sand of Polk County.
I support this legislation because I do think this hits that sweet spot. It's not a direct command from state government pressing down on the localities that it's going to be a certain way. It empowers the local governments to craft the most efficient structure possible for delivering the necessary service of water for the residents of this area.
The final public hearing this week involved two bills that would rein in workers' compensation claims in Iowa. Speakers were split in their opinions about the changes. Labor groups say the cuts would diminish benefits to vulnerable injured workers. Kelly Harrison of the United Auto Workers Union said that repetitive trauma injuries are hard to prove, and it's hard to get insurance companies to cover their treatment.
We have people that work overhead all day long doing this type of work, or they're twerking things over their head, they get a shoulder injury. These folks are real people. They're not robots. You can't just squeak, you know, put a little grease in there and they're okay. We're talking about hardworking men and women.
But Ron Stanhope of the Vermeer Corporation told the committee the new measures might help prevent issues when companies end up paying for treatment for existing conditions that were not caused by the worker's job.
Many times we have had pre-existing injuries or permanent restrictions that were not disclosed by a new hire during the pre-hire process, only later to have an aggravation resulting in multiple claims on multiple employers with multiple payouts, even though there is no greater loss of physical ability or an increase in physical restrictions.
Well, four public hearings in 1 week at the Iowa State Legislature is unusual during any session, but this session has been unusually active and controversial. Steve Warnstadt knows that from experience. The Western Iowa Tech Community College Government Relations Coordinator served as the Democratic State Senator from the 1st District from 2003 until 2011. Warnstadt says he's been surprised by the number and intensity of this year's public hearings.
The public hearings down at the State House, I mean, it happens occasionally. It's pretty rare to have this many in a session. And generally when they occur, they are on very emotionally fraught or very significant pieces of legislation. It is very unusual to have, three in a day. I don't recall really having been in a session where there were three in a session, let alone three in 1 day. So this is highly unusual.
A lot of people coming to these are very upset about the bills, whether it's the minimum wage bill tonight. They'll be talking about workers' compensation. I believe in the voter ID bill, you had more of a split in opinion in that particular session. But are you at all surprised about the anger that you see there?
I don't know that I'm necessarily surprised. I mean, I think part of it is it's the culmination, it's the cumulative effect, and not so much the individual legislation that is causing so much emotional reaction to what's going on. I mean, it's one thing to have one of these bills, again, one or two per session, but having several of them coming continuously has caused a lot of concern for a lot of folks. So not necessarily surprised given the significant changes that are occurring.
Well, for all the people that come down, and hundreds of people have come down and given their opinions, mm-hmm. how much do their opinions actually matter when it comes time to vote on these bills?
That's a really good question. I don't know. You did see some changes that took place on the collective bargaining bill, but were those a result solely of the hearing down in Des Moines, or was it at some of the town meetings or what? I mean, it's difficult to prove causation. I think they do contribute to at least providing some degree of modification to legislation. Generally speaking, though, when the bills get to that point, the intent of the majority party is clearly to bring them up. So it's not going to stop the legislation generally, but it can cause some modifications to the rougher, some of the rougher edges of the policy.
Do you think it's going to make a difference to the Republicans, especially in the House and the Senate? A lot of people have gotten up there and said some very nasty things about Republicans and the bills and what they are considering to be their tactics that are unfair. Do you think that this affects how they look at what they're doing, or do they sort of look at that and say, well, we knew we were going to make some people angry, so it's really no surprise to us?
Yeah, I mean, again, I don't want to get myself into the mind projecting the psychology and figuring out what it is that they're thinking. I don't know that the emotional reaction, and an emotional reaction is necessarily going to have the desired effect among the policymakers. Some of them, sometimes I think on an individual basis, there are a couple that probably like to see that because if they're aggravating certain folks, then they think they must be doing their job. I don't think that's true for all of them, or even the majority of them, or a large portion of them. But having the factual consequences and often the unintended consequences and being able to explain what you're doing may have the unintended consequence of doing A, B, and C may cause them to think and say, ooh, I really don't want to do that. It's probably a better tactic than calling them every name in the book to get them to change the policy. But some people just want to be able to express their feelings and get it off their chest, they can do that. It this isn't going to have much of an effect on the policy itself in doing that.
It gives people a feeling of empowerment, for sure.
You know, sometimes it's very important to tell truth to power, but if that's all you're trying to do is to tell truth to power and not have an impact on the policy, then I guess it fits the goal. I've generally been one to advocate people to go out and try to change the policy, because at the end of the day, it's what's written in the code that really matters, and trying to find ways where you know, I have always found that it's better. It's easy to, you can disagree without being disagreeable and have a bigger impact. Other people have a different mindset, and, you know, that's why we're all created a little bit differently.
A lot of people at these hearings who've testified have said, we're going to remember this in 2018. We're going to remember this in the next election. Do you find that to be true? Do you think when these things are said and the election is, what, a year, year and a half out, do you think these things are remembered?
Certainly for the folks that are saying them, yeah. The question is how large a percentage of the population feels the same way. And you really don't know, because there are so many things that can happen in the next 18 months that are going to potentially it's not that it minimizes it, but it's the things that are most fresh in people's memory that they often tend to vote on. But by the same token, some of these bills may create such an impression on people that anything else that is done is going to have no impact on those individuals and may remain a motivating factor for the general election. So it really depends upon what portion of the population is moved by those immediate impressions and those that are more impacted by the ones that are closer to the election.
There have been a lot of cuts to higher education during this session, to both the regions, institutions, and community colleges. How many more cuts, or how much more do you think will be cut out of the budgets before the session is over?
I don't know, and the sad thing is it remains a distinct possibility, because the Revenue Estimating Conference will meet again next week, and they had built their recommendation was, their assessment in December was that there would be a 4.2% revenue increase. Right now, after 8 months, it's been 1.9% revenue increase, so there's the better part of a $200 million gap there, somewhere between $150 and $200 million. If that continues, then the legislature will either have to dip into the cash reserve fund or cut spending again. And given what we've seen, I don't know that higher education is going to be exempt again. And it's causing huge problems for us, especially when we hear a lot of rhetoric about wanting to have a skilled workforce, wanting to, you know, improve the lives of people and help them work their way up to the middle class on the ladder of success. And the actions taken thus far are making it more and more difficult. And so there's a distinct possibility we'll be cut again this fiscal year, the one that ends June 30th. And it's hard to predict what we're going to be getting for July 1st for the following fiscal year. And then based upon having at least two cuts this year, can we really believe the legislature and the governor, if they do promise more money, that it won't be cut sometime next year? It's very unpredictable, and it's a lot of the people we're dealing with have enough unpredictability without having policymakers foist more unpredictability on them.
At the University of Iowa, they ended up sort of, you know, stepping back from a decision to cut some of the scholarships. Some of those scholarships were going to students from two-year schools, community colleges, into four-year schools.
Yes, and it was rather aggravating to me in particular, given that I work in that field a lot, to hear all of those scholarships being described as non-merit-based, when one of those scholarships was the academic achievement scholarship for community colleges, which required a 3.85 GPA and 30 credit hours. Now, if that isn't merit, I have no idea what is. And so I'm glad that they took that decision back. It does enable and empower students to go to a community college and then go to the Regents, which is far more affordable for them and far more cost effective for the state. It's difficult to make cuts. And that was an easier one at initial blush to cut, and now I think they saw the ramifications that that does not help. So glad to see them move back on that policy. I think the key thing is for people to remain engaged. Legislators are responsive to issues that get brought up, and there's a lot of consternation sometimes at those town meetings, but it actually shows high level of interest. And what people need to do is maintain that level of interest, because ultimately policymakers do respond to what people have to say. And if people don't say anything, then you can pretty much rest assured that they won't listen.
Steve Warnstadt is the Government Relations Coordinator at Western Iowa Tech Community College. He served as a Democrat from Iowa's 1st District in the State Senate from 2003 to 2011. Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. There have also been many contentious bills up for debate in the South Dakota legislature this session. On the heels of President Donald Trump's efforts to check immigration from 7 largely Muslim countries, Republicans created a group of bills that would have called for more oversight for the work done by the state's lone social service agency that resettles immigrants and refugees. Two of those bills were defeated in committee, and Tuesday, a call to commend President Trump for his work in combating Islamic State group terrorism was quickly shelved. And Tuesday, a call to commend President Donald Trump for his work in combating Islamic State group terrorism was quickly shelved. The resolution that initially condemned the system in place for vetting and resettling refugees in the state tried to block refugees whose beliefs could be diametrically opposed to freedom. It was tabled in the Senate on a 20-15 vote. Representatives from Lutheran Social Services, the Sioux Falls Muslim Community, and refugees urged lawmakers not to support the proposal as they viewed it as unnecessary and discriminatory. Betty Oldenkamp is the president and CEO of Lutheran Social Services of South Dakota. She says she's relieved that the Senate resolution was roundly defeated on Tuesday. Oldenkamp says the organization has worked with refugees from the countries on the 7-country ban.
In recent years, we have resettled a number of people that are from Somalia or from Sudan. We've also resettled a significant number of refugees that are Bhutanese or Burmese. Historically, we've worked with Eastern European populations, Vietnamese. It is a wide range, but recent years, there have been refugees that we have resettled from those countries that are listed in the 7-state ban at this point.
I listened to some of the testimony at the last hearing on this, and some of the stories from people are just very touching.
Yes, they are.
Were you at that hearing?
Yes, I was. Yes, I did testify in the opposition to the bill, and there were many very, very powerful stories. I think whether it's people who are of the Islamic faith or people of a Christian faith that come to this country, whether it is by immigration and more willful, deliberate choice, or whether it's through a refugee status where they are fleeing persecution in their homelands and coming to America. I don't think that this resolution gives credibility to the contribution that they make to South Dakota and to our country. I don't think that it gives, that it recognizes the positive power of Islam as a faith. It chooses only to identify negative aspects of that faith. I think that, you know, at least for me, that no religion or race is immune to the atrocities of terrorism. So, and so that to isolate in this resolution just Islam in association with terrorism, it's very wrong. It's very offensive. I think it's important to know that there are many of our senators that have been very supportive of the Muslim community in South Dakota and who do not agree with these resolutions. And even some of those that may have signed on in to the measure initially, or perhaps voted for the amendment on the resolution versus letting it go forward in its original form. There's a lot of factors that influence those votes, and they're not always necessarily just a statement of full support of the words in the measure. And it's obviously there's a lot involved in any political process. But we are continuing to work. I personally have great faith in the members of our state Senate, and I certainly hope that they will stand against this and vote against this when it comes to the floor next week.
What would happen if the bill were approved? How would that affect what you do?
It's a Senate resolution, and it is a resolution. It would not become, it doesn't have the force of law. So it's more of a position or policy statement, but it does not become part of the codified law for South Dakota. If it passes the Senate, it would then need to go over to our House of Representatives and be concurred in by them. And so next week is the last week of our legislative session, except for the day reserved for veto considerations. And so there's not much time left, but it does have to be approved by both bodies before it is enacted. And then it would be, I'm assuming, because it says that it is it's a commendation really to the president, and so I'm assuming it would be a statement that would be presented to President Trump on behalf of the South Dakota legislature. It doesn't change law. It doesn't change regulation. It's making a public statement that has a significant impact on those residents of South Dakota that believe in Islam.
That was Betty Oldenkamp. She's the president and CEO of Lutheran Social Services of South Dakota. LSS is currently the only refugee resettlement organization working in that state. This week, the state Senate voted down a resolution that would have condemned the practice of resettling refugees in that state. You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. Siouxland Public Media is producing a new program entitled We Are Not a Monolith, hosted by Shelby Pierce and Ike Rayford. We Are Not a Monolith will explore the culture and issues facing African Americans in Siouxland, Features and interviews by Shelby and Ike will appear on The Exchange and as a podcast for now, but we hope to make it into its own show in the future. For its debut, our host discussed the film Get Out, written and directed by Jordan Peele, a comedian who turned to horror in order to raise issues of race.
You got your toothbrush?
Check.
Do you have your deodorant?
Check.
Do you have your cozy clothes?
Got that.
What?
Do they know I'm black?
Should they?
You might wanna, you know.
Mom and Dad, my black boyfriend will be coming up this weekend. I just don't want you to be shocked that he's a black man.
We're just going to put this out there. Get Out is a movie that you definitely have to see.
Exactly. Every black person.
Every person. Every person has to go see Get Out. No, so Get Out is a really great and important movie. First of all, it is a horror film. Secondly, I don't recommend that you Google it because you might get a spoiler. So this is a really important movie that you don't get spoiled. But the premise of it is this couple, interracial couple,
yep. Right?
Dating. Rose and Chris. Chris is a young black man, and he's going to meet her parents for the first time.
Right.
So anyways, it's written for modern times.
Very.
They head back up to her to meet her family up in, I believe that they're in New York State.
Right.
And when they get there, he meets her family. Things seem pretty on point. And then they start getting really, really weird.
Very weird.
Very weird.
Good to see another brother around here. Yes, of course it is. Something wrong?
There you are. Do something with this.
Yes.
Oh, hello. I'm Philomena, and you are...
Chris, Rose's boyfriend.
Chris was just telling me how he felt much more comfortable with my being here.
That's nice.
I think as a culture, we have gotten really used to seeing the African-American experience through a lens of either reverence, right? Hidden Figures is a wonderful example of a movie that brings to light the contributions of African Americans in space race. And then we also see the black experience from historical offerings, right? From slavery and the Civil War and the Civil Rights Movement. I think we have as a culture, have had a really reverent perspective toward the black experience. And Get Out it actually is like another, in my opinion, reverent viewing of the black experience, but through the lens of horror, like through the, like, your worst fear of what's your worst fear of going to meet your significant other's family that's a totally different race from you.
Well, I have to say this because I thought it was pretty funny. One of my goddaughters, she was like, "Hey, have you seen the movie Get Out?" I said, "Oh, I'm going to see it because somebody else told me I need to go see it." And she said, and this is the funniest, she says, "If you are a black man dating a white woman, you see that movie, you're done."
This is Nielsen and Alisa.
Hey, how you doing?
So, how handsome is he?
Are you handsome?
Okay.
Oh.
Not bad. Hey, Nielsen.
The director and producer of this movie is someone you most likely have already encountered, but as a comedian, it's Jordan Peele.
Mr. Jordan Peele.
Mr. Jordan Peele, yeah. So he had a show called Key and Peele, which was on Comedy Central. Turns out the man loves horror.
Which is crazy because, you know, he's funny.
Yeah, he's funny, right? So he brings this new twist to this conversation. He actually refers to this movie as a social commentary. One of his favorite movies is The Stepford Wives, and said he largely based this movie on
that. And I can see that resemblance. I didn't know that, but hearing that is like, oh, okay, I see it. I see where he's going with this thing.
Makes sense.
Absolutely.
Yeah, makes sense. Another interesting thing about Jordan Peele is that he is a mixed race black man who is married. He's in an interracial marriage. His wife, Chelsea Peretti, she's also another comedian. She is white, so...
Interesting.
That's right, Ike. So when your daughter says, all black men might be done with their white girlfriends, yeah, right?
He can't be, right?
No, no, he's not. He's in it home. For the long haul, right?
Exactly.
But in
but
that...
But his wife knows what he's thinking.
That's right. So in that, I think that he brings a really unique perspective to the creation of this show to take this conversation to a place that it just hasn't gone before in the past.
Sir, can I see your license, please?
Wait, why?
Yeah, I have state ID.
No. He wasn't driving.
I didn't ask who was driving. I asked to see his ID.
Yeah, why? That doesn't make any sense.
Here.
You don't have to give him your ID because you haven't done anything wrong.
Baby, it's okay. Come on. Anytime there is an incident, we have every right to ask. Ma'am,
One of the metaphors that's drawn is the paralysis that experiencing racism can really cause in one's life, right?
Right.
That when you're confronted with especially subversive racism, like where someone's not necessarily, where somebody might not necessarily be meaning to be offensive to you,
right?
Or somebody is, but they're shrouding it in something different. How paralyzing that experience can feel, right? And how isolating it can feel. This is not a spoiler, but it is an aspect of the movie that at one point Chris gets hypnotized and he's completely paralyzed. And I've seen the... a lot of parallels being drawn to what racism, the experiencing racism, how that is very similar to his experience.
Right. Well, even when, they're approached by the police officer. And I thought, wow, especially when, she was protecting, I guess, if that's a, I could use that word. And it does make you think about even the things that are going on today in our lives and with Black Lives Matter. What can you say to a cop versus what someone else can say?
Right.
We talk about privilege and what that really means to somebody. I mean, a lot of times we when we talk about white privilege, we talk about it in relations to men because we talk about white men having this and that and that.
Yeah.
But even with women, just the fact that you are white, you have some privilege. And how that can be used, in your favor or whatever.
And Rose, the character that we're talking about, is played by Allison Williams. She did a fantastic job of this when they got pulled over by the police. Actually, excuse me, they didn't get pulled over.
No.
She'd hit a deer. The police officer was called out to the scene, and he was asking Chris for his identification, and she stepped in and said he wasn't driving.
Right.
Right? But it's an interesting exercise in... She recognized it right away, right? And then she was just not having it.
Right, and Chris is like, hey, it's not
and
a problem.
He was like, here's my officer. ID, officer.
Right, because you know how it goes down.
Right, or how you don't want it to go down, right? And he's exactly. like, calm down, Rose, it's fine. And she's like, no, absolutely not.
Totally.
Anyway, it is a fantastic movie. Cannot recommend it high enough. Even if you don't like scary movies, I encourage you to challenge yourself to this movie.
And I think even if you don't like scary movies, I think you will be mildly surprised. There are some points. There was a young lady who there was one point where something happened and a young lady like screamed and jumped, but nobody else did. And so we all laughed because we're like, what was that?
I recommend going to see it with another human being. That would be a good idea.
Exactly.
Ideally someone you can grab the arm of because you'll have those moments. So
how long has this been going on? This thing.
We Are Not a Monolith is hosted by Shelby Pierce and Ike Rayford. Look for more of their work in the future on our website, Facebook page, and soon as a podcast on iTunes. You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. Coming up this weekend, Lamb Arts Regional Theater presents Death of a Salesman, the iconic 1949 Pulitzer Prize-winning play by Arthur Miller. In this drama, Willie Loman has spent his life following the American way, but somehow the riches and respect he covets have eluded him. He lives in a fragile world of excuses and daydreams. He desperately tries to make sense of himself and of the world around him that once promised so much. Siouxland Public Media's Allie Carson talked with the lead of the show, who was, in fact, a salesman himself.
Am I a success? Why am I here? What is my self-worth? If I wasn't here, would anybody notice? You don't necessarily have to pick up those two sample cases and trudge down the road like Willie used to do. But you get up in the morning and get in your car and go to your computer screen. Is what I am doing worthwhile?
That's Russell Woolley, the Managing Artistic Director at Lamb Arts Regional Theater and Siouxland Public Media's Artist of the Month. He is playing Arthur Miller's modern tragic hero, Willie Loman, in Death of a Salesman, opening this Friday with a Projects of Hope night in which ticket sales will benefit the Siouxland Mental Health Center.
This has been on my list to do for quite a few years. But Willie struggles with finding purpose. Willie struggles with being a success and knowing inside that he isn't, not only with his marriage, but with his salesmanship, but being a good father to his boys. And those are themes that I dare say lots of people are going to see. Oh, my goodness. And so it is how he deals with it, how it affects everybody around him, which makes for a good story.
Putting yourself out there all the time, again and again, making an emotional appeal that all but cries, pick me, pick me. Doing that is rife with rejection. Wait, are we talking about sales or theater?
I was a salesman, I mean, a good and true salesman for many years, almost 20 years at the Sioux City Journal, and before that in insurance, because I got out of school, and with my training as an actor, I found it a really good fit. Because I can think on my feet, that was pretty logical. Selling is an incredibly emotional job. There would be days when I was selling insurance, I'd go out and I'd make $1,000, $1,200 in a day. And then there would be 3 days in a row where you sold nothing. And so you're up, you're down. One of the things that you have to do is you have to pound it into your head that they're not saying no to you, they are saying no to your product. Or they're saying no at this moment. And so it is a very emotional game. And to count yourself as a real successful salesman, you have to be in it for the long run. And you have to make those decisions and tell yourselves those things. Now, in the theater, again, I still am a salesman because we sell the theater. We literally sell tickets. We sell our classes. And so a sage long time ago told me nothing moves unless it's sold. And I dare say that's a very true statement.
I don't know that I've ever asked you, you know, like what was your first exposure to theater? You know, what got you into it?
When I was in high school, I was a jock. Football, basketball, I was terrible in track. But I was also in all the speech stuff. Debate, speech, extemporaneous speech, and then the plays. We had Mrs. Vera Fast, wonderful, wonderful lady that directed the plays. She was an English teacher. But we really didn't do anything substantial. I still remember a couple of the titles. We did a little comedy called Man Overboard. And another one was called Love is Too Much Trouble. You know, we didn't do good shows, but I did all of those. I was on stage. So I went to the University of South Dakota. I was going to be a coach, because I love sports, going to be a coach and teach biology. That's what I was going to do. And I got there, and I'm taking all those classes, and I saw a sign, auditions for in the theater department. Well, that's something that I did, too. So I went over and auditioned. And I was cast as Sancho in a children's production of the story of Don Quixote. That was it. Changed my major. I'm going to be a theater major. I'm going to be a theater major. My parents said, what? And I just said, this is what I have to do.
What was it about it? I mean, that changed your mind.
For those of us who have the passion to tell the stories, we have to tell the stories.
Much like his careening career path, early on, Woolley never intended to put down roots in Sioux City, but did so nonetheless.
You know, when you're a young guy, you graduate from high school, you never think you're going to stay where you grew up, oh my gosh, that would be just the most terrible thing that ever happened to you. Not said, no.
What changed your mind?
Well, when Diane and I got together 38 years ago, we had this very young idea of let's start our own theater company. After 37 years, it's still here. It's been fun, exhilarating, frustrating, hard as hell. But we've built an organization that provides a lot of tremendous entertainment, tremendous education for students. It's a really vibrant, creative place to be. And you just have to thank our audience members for coming, because that's the reason we're here.
Well, what has changed since you started? You know, have audience attendance habits shifted or changed?
Oh, very, very much. We have seen a steady decline in audience attendance numbers. Very, very, very steady. Not just Lamb Theater. That is seen all over the country. Lots of things going on. Young people aren't in the habit of going to the theater. I teach as an adjunct at both Morningside College and Western Iowa Tech. Introduction to theater and acting. And in my intro class, one of my first questions is, how many of you go to the theater on a regular basis? Meaning, once or twice a season. And I am lucky if I get one or two hands up. Our struggle is getting young people to come. That's why the school is important for us. That's why for Death of a Salesman, we have 120, 130 AP English classes from the high schools coming in for a special daytime performance. We've got to acquaint them. When I teach my classes, I pick a show that we are producing on our stage. I give them tickets to it. They will read the show, they will come and see the show, and then a lot of discussion, and then they hand in a paper. Again, it's terrific. I have people coming, they've never been to live theater before, and they come and they, well, that was really good. Yes, it is. It was really something to see. They were right up there, you know, doing that stuff. How'd you do all that? I mean, once we get them in, it is such a wonderful experience, so different than movies, video games, and all the rest of that. It's tough to get them in. There's so much competition with TV and this and that and everything else that's going on. But yeah, that's one of the things that has changed. Technology's changed tremendously,
yeah, I mean,
too.
Technology has brought entertainment into our hands, essentially, you know, mm-hmm.
You can watch a movie on your phone.
Yeah, so just, you know, getting people to leave their homes when, you know, these on-demand entertainment options are available to them whenever they want.
Yeah,
it's on 24/7, demand.
Yeah.
Willie isn't worried about the death of the theater. He remains hopeful that the staying power of storytelling will sustain the performing arts for many years to come. Death of a Salesman is showing at Lamb Arts Regional Theater March 10 through 26. For more information, visit lambtheater.com. The music you've heard throughout this interview was composed by Diana Woolley for the production of Death of a Salesman. For Siouxland Public Media, I'm Allie Carson.
Thank you, Allie. And that's it for this week's edition of The Exchange. Be sure to join us next week when we'll talk about the controversy over efforts to do away with the Des Moines Waterworks and how that connects with a lawsuit over nitrates in the Raccoon River. Also, there's an effort right now to create a historic district in downtown Sioux City, and we'll see what's going on at the legislature next week as well. Sure to be more drama at the Iowa State House and Senate. Thanks today for help from everyone at Siouxland Public Media, Allie Carson, Mark Munger, Steve Smith, Rick Turner. Also, thanks today to Shelby Pierce and Ike Rayford. Hopefully we'll hear from you very soon once again.